Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in the news. First of all, over a week and a half ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission broke a 30-year hiatus in the fortunes of nuclear energy, and approved the licensing of two new nuclear power plants. This is potentially a game changer. And we should also point out that next month is the first year anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. So we'll be giving you an update as to what's happening in Japan, not to mention the fact that the Middle East is heating up, with the Iranian situation going right down to the wire, with senior U.S. officials saying that a strike, a military strike on Iran, could come as early as spring. However, before we begin with a summary of the news, let me make a short announcement. And that is, my latest book, Physics of the Future, is now in paperback form. And I'll be on a book tour, and if you want to know which cities I'll be in to sign your copy of Physics of the Future, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Maybe I'll be passing through your city signing your copy of Physics of the Future. Let me also point out that several radio stations around the country are using Physics of the Future as part of their fundraising drive. I believe that we have to support listener-sponsored free speech radio, and the publisher is actually donating some free copies of the book so that your local radio station can be alive and well. So once again, my latest book, Physics of the Future, is in paperback form. It was a New York Times bestseller. It hit number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list, not to mention the fact that Amazon chose my book as one of the 100 top books of 2011 in any category. And again, the Physics of the Future talks about, well, the future, the next 20, 50, 100 years, based on interviews I've done with over 300 of the world's top scientists for BBC Television, the Discovery Channel, the Science Channel, and of course, for Exploration on your local radio station. So find out about the future of medicine, the future of space travel, robotics, artificial intelligence, computers. What about jobs? What jobs are doomed for extinction? What jobs are going to thrive in the future? And what about the wealth of nations? Science is the engine driving prosperity around the world. And if you understand science, then you understand where the jobs are going to be that will dominate our future. And then we should also point out that we're going to bring on our special guest after summarizing the top stories. And after that, we're going to bring on our special guest today. It's a pre-recorded interview with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service talking about President Barack Obama's nuclear renaissance. Is this going to be a game changer for the future with the Obama administration pushing the fortunes of nuclear energy? Or will it simply make worse the environmental degradation of the planet? Okay, well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The big story is, about a week and a half ago, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission gave the green light for not one, but two new nuclear power plants to be built 170 miles east of Atlanta, Georgia. This is the first time in over 30 years since 1978, since before Three Mile Island, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has issued a license for a nuclear power plant. That's how historic this decision was, and it wasn't unanimous. In fact, the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted no. He was the lone dissenting vote, saying that we still have not yet digested all the lessons from the Fukushima disaster. Now, these nuclear power plants, well, they're not cheap. $14 billion for two units. That's $7 billion apiece. And remember, back in the 1950s, scientists and politicians said that nuclear energy would be too cheap to meter. Well, at $7 billion apiece, that is certainly a lot of cost for a nuclear power plant. And the design of the nuclear power plant is a little bit different from before. It's called the AP1000. And the boosters of nuclear energy say that it's safer than a conventional plant because it uses gravity and it uses condensation naturally as a way to control the overheating of the reactor. For example, instead of having pumps drive water up into the core in case of an accident, you use gravity. Gravity to pull water down so that gravity works in your favor rather than working against you. Some nuclear power plants, for example, have control rods underneath the reactor that shoot the rods vertically up using all sorts of valves and pumps. However, why not have the control rods on top of the reactor so that gravity naturally lets the rods flow into the core, putting on the brakes of the nuclear power plant? So the boosters of nuclear power say that it's safer. The critics of nuclear power say, well, it's not enough. The basic design is still the same. You have 100 tons of uranium dioxide that could overheat and melt within about an hour, and you have the problem of nuclear waste, and it got worse under President Barack Obama because he shut down the nuclear waste dump in Yucca Mountains in Nevada. So at the present time, there is no permanent repository for nuclear waste in the United States. We should also point out that over half the nuclear power plants in the country are over 30 years of age and will, in fact, be decommissioned in the coming years. In fact, there are 104 plants at 64 sites, meaning that a huge number of nuclear power plants will be decommissioned in the coming years. We should also point out that 18% of electricity in the U.S. comes from nuclear. However, 43% of our electricity comes from coal. Natural gas contributes 25%, wind 3%, biomass 2%, and solar, which is the darling of environmentalists, contributes only 1% of our electricity in the United States. Well, the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted against his own committee, saying that we have not yet digested the lessons of Fukushima. And that whole thing is heating up. The latest information from the Fukushima reactor is that the accident was much worse than we were led to believe. We had not a partial core meltdown. For the first time in history, we actually had the complete liquefaction of the core at a nuclear power plant. We've never seen this before. 100% liquefaction of the core. In fact, the core liquefied at Fukushima. It dripped down to the bottom of the containment where it ate away at the containment and made a hole. Then it seeped down the hole at the bottom of the containment and then went all the way down to the bottom of the reactor itself. And so we had liquefaction of the core causing a hole to be drilled right through the vessel, leading to the uranium coming all the way down to the bottom. Now, workers at the site were able to actually put in a camera into the reactor to take the first preliminary pictures. The pictures are very blurry. They don't really show much, but a hole was drilled to the side of the Mark I General Electric boiling water reactor in Fukushima. And at the end of this rod was a light and a TV camera. So now they're beginning to try to photograph what is left of the cores. But as I mentioned before, there's nothing left of the cores at all. Also, the utility has admitted that it could take up to 40 years to clean up the mess. That is the extent of the accident, 40-year cleanup. Remember that at a Three Mile Island, it was a 14-year cleanup, and the core was only partially melted, and not much fission products were released into the environment. In contrast, the cores at Fukushima, three of them melted, some of them completely liquefied, and deadly radiation did seep into the environment. In fact, if you visit Japan, every day there are reports of radiation being found in all sorts of places, even past Tokyo, 150 miles from the reactor itself. There are pictures, in fact, showing the radiation levels surrounding the Fukushima plant, showing that a good chunk of northern Japan has, in fact, been contaminated by the radiation. It's getting in the food. In fact, many housewives routinely buy nuclear counters in order to calculate for their own benefit how much radiation they're going to be giving their children. Now, to be fair, we're not talking about lethal quantities of radiation. It's very small, but it's radiation levels that can, in fact, be picked up even by housewives who buy these radiation meters. And then the question is, if the core liquefied at Fukushima, then what prevented the China syndrome? The China syndrome is when radiation simply leaks out of the reactor, melts right through the containment structure, hits water, and creates a steam explosion, which then blows the whole roof of the reactor apart. What prevented that? Well, we now know the answer to that, too. One of the workers at the site was given an order not to inject seawater into the cores, which would destroy the cores totally, because the utility wanted to eventually clean up the mess and start up the reactor again. He disobeyed orders. He disobeyed a direct order from the utility, and he flushed seawater, corrosive seawater, into the reactors, stopping the accident. That was the only correct decision made in the first few days of the accident, and the decision was made by one worker going against the orders of his own utility. We should also point out that at Tokyo University, scientists there say that the probability of a Tokyo earthquake, which is potentially infinitely more dangerous than the Fukushima-type tsunami, a Tokyo earthquake has a 70% chance of taking place over the next 4 years. Let me repeat that again. According to the seismologists at Tokyo University, one of the leading organizations of seismologists in the world, there is a 70% chance of a major Tokyo earthquake in the next 4 years. And that Tokyo earthquake, in turn, could wipe out not just Tokyo, but Kobe and Osaka, Kyoto, and many other cities. And again, no one knows for sure when we're going to have the next big one, but a Tokyo earthquake would be infinitely worse than what happened at Fukushima. And speaking about the nuclear option, the Iranian situation is heating up, and in fact, it will probably flash into perhaps a major war starting this spring, according to a senior official within the Obama administration. No one knows for sure, but it looks like it's going to go right down to the wire. On one hand, the Iranians say that it's all for peaceful purposes, that they have to have uranium power in order to power up their cities. It's a domestic situation, they say. On the other hand, other people say that Iran has no need for electricity because they're rolling in oil. They're one of the largest oil producers in the world. And second of all, why bother to put a safe commercial plant underground in one of the sites that is hardened to withstand a direct attack by the United States? It doesn't look right. Why would a commercial plant be placed underground at enormous expense? The United States military has admitted that the new nuclear site, which was uncovered recently, a secret site, is so far underground that it's probably impossible for earth penetrators and bunker busters in the U.S. arsenal to, quote, take it out. So what's happening? Well, we do know that the Iranians have the ability to enrich uranium to 20%, far beyond the 3% necessary to operate a commercial nuclear power plant. 20% is important because once you have uranium at 20% enrichment, you can then, quote, break out at any point, and rapidly go to 90%, which is weapons-grade enrichment. So will it lead to war or not? Well, I certainly don't know. But the Iranians do seem to be going for the capability of, quote, a breakout, so that even though it is, quote-unquote, peaceful at the present time, they reserve the option of racing and sprinting toward a nuclear bomb at will. And that, of course, is a potential game changer with regards to a potential strike. How close are they? Well, analysts say that the Iranians may be a year to 2 years before they finally put the last screw in an atomic bomb. Well, let's hope cooler heads prevail and we avoid another catastrophic war. Let's hope and pray for a diplomatic solution to this problem. To introduce our special guest today, we're very delighted to have with us Michael Marriott, a director at NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington. And we're going to talk today about the Fukushima nuclear accident 5 months later. What about the long-term implications? What about the cleanup operation? What's happening in Europe? What about President Barack Obama's plan to have a nuclear renaissance? These and other questions we'll discuss with Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS. Michael, first question for you is, explain, what is NIRS?
Well, NIRS is Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We're an organization founded in 1978 to serve what was then and remains today a very decentralized grassroots movement against nuclear power and for safe and clean energy sources. We work to achieve a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy future. And we monitor what's happening in Washington as well as around the world, really, get the information to the people across the country, help them understand it, and help them use it. We have a website at NIRS.org, and we also have three different Facebook pages, and we're on Twitter, so our outreach is getting pretty good.
Okay, so what is your spin on the Fukushima nuclear accident? Many people have analyzed it, but what are your thoughts? How severe was the accident? And then, of course, we'll talk about the long-term implications.
Well, of course, at Fukushima, we had multiple meltdowns, something few people ever thought would happen. We had multiple fuel pool failures, something few people ever thought would happen, and we had them all at the same time. In a lot of ways, this was the most challenging nuclear accident ever. It remains to be seen whether it will eventually rank as the most catastrophic nuclear accident ever, or whether it will be, right up there with Chernobyl or not, because, one key thing is that, this is an accident that isn't over. The reactors continue to leak radiation. Currently, according to our best information, the levels are much, much lower than they were a few months ago, but they are still continuing at about a billion becquerels per hour, according to our best information. At the height of the accident, just for comparison, they were putting out hundreds of thousands of trillions of becquerels per day. So it's obviously gone down. But none of the reactors are yet in cold shutdown, which means there is still the possibility that new problems could occur, particularly through another earthquake or operator error or any of a number of various potential problems. And it just today, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power admitted that they're probably not going to make cold shutdown by next January as they've been planning. So we still have months to go before we can say this accident is contained, And then even then, we're going to have years and probably decades of pretty dicey cleanup of the mess that's left there. I mean, you know, we have molten fuel at the bottom of three reactors. That's going to be an enormous task to try to deal with over the years. We've got hundreds of thousands of tons of contaminated water in these buildings. Again, that's going to be an enormous cleanup effort. So this is something that's going to be ongoing for a good long time.
And how severe was the accident? We now know from TEPCO's own admission that all three reactors suffered a 100% core melt. All the uranium melted. But what about breachment of containment? Is there any indication that the metal that surrounded the reactors actually began to melt and perhaps even leaked out some molten uranium?
It's very clear that there was indeed a breach of containment. Even the Nuclear Regulatory Commission admits that for at least some of the reactors. In fact, just before we began this interview, I was reading the Fukushima Task Force report, and it acknowledges that there was indeed breach of containment. We don't know how severe the breaches were because nobody can, of course, get there to take a look. The radiation levels are too high. But we also know that it's far more severe than Japan let on initially. And in particular, our belief is that the Unit 3 in particular, we believe there was probably an explosion in the fuel pool there, and that caused the fuel fragments to be blown across the area, across the site. And we think that's what accounts for some very extraordinarily high radiation readings that were found at Fukushima earlier this month. You know, the highest readings yet. And we believe that this is because there are, you know, basically pieces of hot fuel around the site that haven't been measured yet, and there's probably pieces of hot fuel throughout the evacuation zone you know, with extraordinarily high levels of radiation. And again, this is something that's going to take months and years to deal with.
And what about the contamination that continues to come out of the reactor? What about contamination that's affected drinking water, milk, vegetation, farm products, fish? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, Japan has a very serious problem with contamination of food stuff right now. There have been, you know, numerous reports of contaminated beef, contaminated mushrooms, contaminated tea. I think the entire country is holding its breath now as the rice harvest is getting ready to go to market to see how contaminated that may be. And you know, most of this contamination is caused by the you know, the initial releases are early in the accident that were spewed over a large part of the countryside, especially to the northwest of the plant. But if you look at the radiation maps, just you're all over the place. You know, 100, 120 miles away, there's hot spots that are quite contaminated. And so the contamination of elements like cesium-137 and others, it gets into the soil, the plant-based food sort of takes it up inside the food, and it becomes contaminated. The cattle were eating contaminated straw and hay. They ingest the radioactive cesium, and then the cattle themselves become radioactive. And it's a very serious problem throughout Japan. Another problem I want to bring up is that large areas of northern Japan that should have been evacuated, that are continuing to experience contamination levels higher than those the Soviet Union evacuated as a result of the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. Hundreds of thousands of people are living in areas like this and not being evacuated, not or probably more appropriately called relocated at this point. And we have situations such as we posted one on Facebook today where you literally have government officials going door to door in certain towns with radiation monitors, and they'll tell people in one household, you can evacuate, we will compensate you. And next door they'll say, you can't because we don't find a hot spot on your land. So it's a very ad hoc way of dealing with this issue, and in our view, a very cruel way of dealing with this issue. And the fact remains, we have hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of children living in zones that are contaminated that should be evacuated. And I'll just make a pitch for this. We have a petition up on our website that we are working on in conjunction with our friends at Green Action Japan, an emergency petition to protect the children of Fukushima, and we hope people will sign that. We, in the early days of the accident, we sent over a number of radiation monitors to Japan through Green Action, and it was through these monitors that the scandal of the radiation levels at Fukushima schools were first discovered. So we were very happy to be part of this effort and part of what's a very a rapidly growing movement of mothers in Japan, you know, mothers in particular, to relocate their children into safer areas. But now that we have the information, now we need to bring about the political change to make it possible.
Now, the Japanese people are normally rather trusting of the government, and now we have a situation where people are buying decimeters and Geiger counters on their own, that local municipalities are giving decimeters to children as young as kindergarten age. So do you see, therefore, that there's a sea change in people's attitude toward nuclear power in Japan?
Absolutely. And you're quite right. You know, the Japanese people had been told for many years, many decades, and this is partly in response to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that they've been told by their government that, yes, nuclear weapons are horrible, look what happened to us, but nuclear power is going to help Japan. And they were assured over and over again of safety, even while the government and the utilities in Japan built nuclear reactors on fault lines and failed to take steps to protect reactors from tsunamis, built reactors such as the General Electric Mark I design, which is what was used at Fukushima, that have received numerous safety criticisms over the years. And the Japanese people, I think, now realize they were sold a bill of goods.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, we began an interview with Michael Marriott, Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C., a nuclear clearinghouse of information. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration as we continue the discussion of the Fukushima accidents and the future of nuclear energy. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, and this is the second half of Exploration. Our special guest, Michael Marriott, is with us today. This is a pre-recorded interview with the director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. And before we begin, let me make an announcement. Once again, I'm on a book tour. My book, Physics of the Future, is now in paperback form. Go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. It gives you my schedule, and perhaps I'll be in a city next to you signing your copy of Physics of the Future, which, as I mentioned, was a New York Times bestseller and one of Amazon's 100 top books for 2011. And it talks about your future, the next 20, 50, the next 100 years in science and the economy. And so once again, the book Physics of the Future is now in paperback form. Now, Mr. Marriott, to continue our interview, okay, now at Three Mile Island, there was no breach of containment, and yet it took 14 years to clean up. The crews had to put in TV cameras to photograph the melted core, and then with hacksaws, hack up the core into pieces and take each piece out, all of which took place underwater. And that was 14 years for a situation that was relatively under control. Do you foresee, therefore, that the cleanup operation at Fukushima could be many times worse?
Absolutely. Three Mile Island was quite easy compared to Fukushima. In fact, I was actually inside Three Mile Island watching the workers practice with these tools they were using. They were these very long-handled tools, about 20 feet long, and like you said, they would stand on this little ledge and try to cut molten fuel 20 feet below them underwater. And that was very easy compared to what's going to happen at Fukushima. Because at Three Mile Island, the fuel remained in the reactor pressure vessel. It was in a relatively small location. At Fukushima, it is melted and has moved out of the vessel. We don't know how far out yet. We may not even know that for years. So, yeah, I think we're looking at, you know, literally decades for cleanup. I know a couple months ago, Tokyo Electric Power received bids from two different companies for cleanup activities. One of the bids said, well, we think we can do it in 10 years, and the other bid said, well, we think we can do it in 30 years. And I think what we're really going to be looking at is decades before we actually have a cleaned up situation at Fukushima. I mean, remember that Chernobyl was 25 years ago. At Chernobyl, they built the sarcophagus fairly quickly, the large steel container around the site, but the sarcophagus at Chernobyl is not adequate, and so they're just now beginning work 25 years later on a more permanent sealing of that reactor. Fukushima is more spread out. There was damage over a wider area. It's going to be extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming and expensive to try to bring about to any sort of normalcy level.
Now, you mentioned 10 to 30-year estimates. One nuclear engineer has estimated that it may take as long as 100 years, a century, to clean up. At Chernobyl, there were 600,000 workers that were involved in that cleanup operation. 600,000 workers. Some of the workers only went in for a few minutes, getting a full year's dose of radiation. So what are your thoughts? You think it's going to take more than 30 years, maybe 50 years? These are the numbers being batted about now.
Well, I think at one level it's just impossible to know. And I mean, I think we're looking at decades easily. How many decades really depends on what is found under these reactors, inside these reactor buildings, when people can finally get into them, and we don't even know when that is going to be. So somebody wants to say a century, I'm not going to disagree with them. You know, it's just impossible to know now, but it's going to be quite a long time, and it's going to be extraordinarily expensive.
Okay, now let's talk about the radioactive fallout from the Fukushima disaster. Just before the nuclear accident, people were saying that there's going to be a nuclear renaissance, that there's going to be a new emphasis on building safer designs of nuclear power, especially in light of the greenhouse effect, that nuclear could be the white knight, with President Barack Obama even endorsing a nuclear renaissance. So let's take it one country at a time. First of all, Germany. What's happening in Germany?
Well, Germany, you know, has had a nuclear phase-out policy in place. In the previous government, the current government overturned that policy when they came to power, Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Party. Now that party and Ms. Merkel have done an about-face, and Germany, in fact, is going to accelerate its nuclear phase-out. Seven reactors are already closed, and the other, I believe it's another 12 that they have, are going to permanently close around the end of this decade. And there is a clear commitment not to build any more. So Germany is leading the way to a non-nuclear future. And what's especially important about Germany, I think, is that they want to do this and are planning to do this in a way that switches them from nuclear and from fossil fuels to renewable sources of power and increased energy efficiency. This is the future that they now see as not only desirable but feasible, and they are likely to show the rest of the world the way to do this, and in that sense they're going to be a terrific example for the rest of the world.
And what about Switzerland?
Switzerland also is ending its use of nuclear power. They won't be building any more. They will be. They have a scheduled phase out for their existing reactors. They only have one or two. They're not nearly as reliant on nuclear as Germany is. And their phase out, I believe, is at a later date than Germany's. You know, they're not making as radical a statement as Germany is at this point. But you know, the trend there again is clear. And, you know, one thing to remember about countries like Germany and Switzerland is these are not the kinds of countries you normally think of as sort of sunny resort areas, and yet these countries are going to be moving aggressively to solar power. You know, in fact, Germany is already the most solar country in the world, and when people understand that countries like this can effectively use solar power, it's very clear that those of us in parts of the world that actually do have greater solar resources, there's no excuse for us not to do it.
And what about Italy?
Italy is interesting because the government there, Berlusconi's government, wanted to renew construction of nuclear power. In Italy, after Chernobyl, there was a referendum, and the people voted no more nuclear. Berlusconi's government has been actively working to overturn that over the last couple of years. And in fact, the Italian utilities have been investing in nuclear plants in other countries, but they wanted to build more in Italy. Well, they had another citizens' referendum just about 6-8 weeks ago, in which the government actively opposed, but the referendum won by some 90% of the vote, and Italy will very clearly not be building more nuclear power plants.
And going back to Japan, Japan, some people say, made the Faustian bargain. Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. Japan has very few alternatives, no coal, no oil, very little hydropower, so they went nuclear. So what's going to happen now with the future of nuclear energy in Japan?
Well, clearly Japan is going to be much, much less reliant on nuclear power than it has been. And the only question is, will it be reliant at all on nuclear power? Most of Japan's reactors are closed. Japan had 55 reactors on March 10th, 2011. Six of those reactors, the ones at Fukushima Daiichi, are not operating, obviously, and are not going to operate again. But a majority of the other reactors across the country also have closed. Some did experience some effects from the earthquake, obviously not as severe as Fukushima. But Japan has an interesting law where in Japan, reactors after 13 months of operation have to close for inspections, safety inspections, and the like, something that we certainly don't do here in the U.S. And another part of the law is that the governors of the prefectures, which is the Japanese equivalent of states, the governors have to approve the restart of the reactors. And if the governor opposes it, doesn't want it, then the reactors can't start up again. So most of Japan's reactors are closed. Most of the governors have indicated they don't want the reactors to reopen, although today, in fact, the first reactor in Japan to restart after Fukushima started, I forget the name of it, but a governor did allow one reactor to start up today. There is a campaign to try to overturn that decision. But, you know, we have a situation where by next spring, the rest of Japan's reactors that are currently operating and have been operating this whole time will be going through their shutdown time, and it's by no means clear that the governors are going to allow the rest of these reactors to start up. So Japan may find itself a no nuclear or a very small nuclear nation by default and by decree of the governors as early as next spring. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister Kan, not particularly popular in Japan right now because of the mishandling of the Fukushima crisis, but he has made it clear that from the government's perspective, the national government's perspective, Japan has to move away from nuclear power and very aggressively go after or improve energy efficiency, although Japan is probably the most energy-efficient country in the world already, and invest heavily in solar and wind power. And Japan does have pretty substantial wind power resources, and in fact, the offshore wind farms in Japan, although they were a little further from the epicenter than the reactors were, they continued operating throughout the earthquake and tsunami, and there's a lot more potential there for power. But that's the direction that Japan is planning to move in over the next decade.
Now let's talk about the United States, with President Barack Obama reaffirming his commitment to nuclear energy even after the Fukushima accident, but he also closed down the Yucca Mountains waste repository. Could you explain?
Well, there's two things. In the United States, there has been much talk about a nuclear renaissance over the past several years. At one point, we had something like applications for, I don't know, as many as 29 or 32 new reactors. In the U.S., the reality is that no licenses have been granted. No reactors are being built right now. Fukushima itself ended one project that was pretty far advanced in South Texas. NRG Energy, which is the lead sponsor of that project, withdrew after Fukushima, partially because one of its investors was, in fact, Tokyo Electric Power. So that one's already ended. And most of the other projects that have been proposed are running into what is for the utilities an unpleasant reality. These reactors cost too much to build. There are competing power sources that cost less to build and operate. And in fact, we are now at the point where even solar power, which has historically been quite expensive, in many parts of the country now, solar power is cheaper than nuclear power. And those parts of the country where it is not yet will be in the coming near-term future. So that if you're a utility executive trying to decide what you're going to build, and of course there's a lead time involved. Nuclear reactors take about 10 years to license and build at a minimum, and you're trying to look, so if you're a utility executive trying to look 10 years ahead, and even now we're seeing that, you know, solar and wind and whether onshore or offshore, and of course natural gas are not only economically competitive with nuclear power, but economically more beneficial than nuclear power, you'd have to be a pretty strange utility executive to invest heavily in nuclear at this point. And in fact, John Rowe, who is the CEO of Exelon, Exelon is the nation's largest nuclear utility, addressed the American Nuclear Society earlier this week and said that while he believes in nuclear power, the economics aren't there, and that in fact the economics for nuclear power in the U.S. have worsened over the past 2 years, to the point where it just doesn't make sense to build nuclear plants in this country. And that's with or without federal support. And because of the the ongoing budget issues and the deficit issues, we're not expecting any additional federal support for nuclear power to be approved. President Obama had asked for $36 billion in taxpayer money for nuclear loans for reactors. We beat him on that last year, and we're winning on that this year as well, and we don't think it's going to happen. So there, and without federal loans, nothing is going to get built.
Now, the utility says, in its defense, that the next generation of reactors is much better than the Three Mile Island-type reactors, which melted down back in 1979. So, describe this new generation of reactors. Are they really that safe?
Well, let me say two things. The reactors that the utilities are actually considering building, in other words, the ones that they have applied for licenses for, are not really a new generation of reactors. They're sort of a half generation of reactors. I sometimes describe them as the difference between a 1970 Chevy Impala and a 2010 Chevy Impala. I mean, they're obviously the 2010 model is probably safer and gets better gas mileage, but it's not much. It's fundamentally technologically not a lot different from the model 30, 40 years ago. And that's the case with the reactors that the utilities have applied to build. These are evolutionary differences between the reactors that exist now. There are reactor designs out there that are being touted by various nuclear proponents that have various features that appeal to the nuclear proponents, and they basically fall into two different categories. There are what's called the small modular reactors, which are far smaller than existing reactors or any that are planned now. Typical reactor in the U.S. is approximately 1,000 megawatts. These would be anywhere from 50 to about 300 megawatts apiece. So, much smaller. The idea is that, if we make them smaller, they'll be cheaper. You could put, several of them together on one site and still produce as much power, but it would be simpler to operate and cheaper to build, in theory. We think in practice, actually, the economic, whatever economic advantage there might seem to be would evaporate in real life, but because, you know, none of these reactors has actually been built, none of them has even been fully designed. But so that's one type of new reactor. The second type are what's called, sometimes called Generation 4 reactors. These, and there's a variety of different ones. What they have in common is that they are all designed on paper. Many of them would have a purported selling feature of using radioactive waste from other reactors as part of their fuel. And this would require implementation of a very large reprocessing structure in the United States that would be expensive, quite dirty, and problematic in a number of ways. In theory, these reactor designs, some of which have been around on paper for many years, some of which haven't, but in theory, these reactor designs would be passively safe, meaning that they wouldn't need a lot of valves and pumps and, you know, pieces that can break in order to ensure cooling, that the cooling would occur naturally. We're quite skeptical of all of these designs. One of them is the Integral Fast Reactor. The climate scientist, James Hansen, who we like a lot otherwise, has been touting these, but they, another is a gas modular reactor, pebble bed modular reactor. These are designs that have been around actually for a couple of decades, and nobody's ever built them because, the economics of them don't make sense, and they probably don't work as well in practice as they might look on paper. We believe that we have the ability to generate the electricity we need through the sun, through the wind, through the water, through renewable means, and using the energy wisely, which means a combination of efficiency, you know, ensuring that everything is operating as efficiently electrically as possible, and sensible conservation, we can meet our electrical needs with those means. We don't need nuclear power of any kind to meet our electricity needs, and this renewable future is becoming reality faster than anybody is really noticing. I was in California last weekend, and I was talking to a friend of mine who's an executive at a large solar firm, and he was explaining to me that currently in California alone, there are proposals that have been filed with the state for 70,000 megawatts of solar power production. And that's not even including, you know, rooftop solar and the types of things that individuals do. By way of comparison, California uses about 60,000 megawatts of power total. This 70,000 megawatts, that's only what's been, on file now. There's obviously plenty of companies that would want to build more. So solar is a rapidly, rapidly growing technology that is finally here. You know, 30 years ago, after Three Mile Island, I'll have to admit, our side, talked a lot about solar power, but solar power wasn't ready then. Wasn't ready for prime time, wasn't ready to power our nation. Things have changed, and solar power in much of the nation, both solar power plants and rooftop solar, home-based solar, industry-based solar, coupled with wind power, and in some cases, in some parts of the country where it can be done cleanly, geothermal power. These are our energy futures. They're here now, and we don't need the Generation 4 design, reactor designs, or any of the other designs that, regardless of their safety claims, which we're skeptical of, still produce radioactive waste.
And last question, what about Yucca Mountains? If the president has closed down, essentially, the Yucca Mountains waste repository, what are we going to do with nuclear waste?
Well, we have on our website a statement of principles that's been signed, endorsed by literally hundreds of organizations across the United States, including just about all of the big environmental groups and all of the nuclear-oriented groups. And it's called HOSS, H-O-S-S, which stands for Hardened On-Site Storage. And what these principles say is basically we know, and it's clear, there is not going to be a permanent radioactive waste dump in the near future in this country. In fact, there's not going to be one anywhere in the world, but that's a different story. Because of that reality, and some of the groups here would like to see such a repository in place, but where it would be is, not been agreed upon yet. But because of this, fundamental reality that we have the waste that has been generated, and we have to deal with it, the best thing we can do with it right now is to store it on site at the reactor site in dry casks. We need to get it out of the fuel pools as quickly as it can be, which is after about 5 years in the fuel pool, because Fukushima has shown us, the vulnerabilities of fuel pools. We need to get it out of the pools, into the casks, and we need to have the casks in such a way that they are protected from both natural disasters and man-made disasters, such as potential terrorists and that kind of thing.
I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Michael Marriott, director of NIRS, the Nuclear Information Resource Service in Washington, D.C. Their website is NIRS.org, N-I-R-S.org. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to check out my latest book, Physics of the Future, now a New York Times bestseller. Good day.